I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The U.S. launched its first drone strike in November 2002 in Yemen, killing an al-Qaeda leader reportedly responsible for the attack on the USS Cole and five others, including an American citizen. Since that time, the country has used drones to attack and kill al-Qaeda suspects in Pakistan and Yemen. American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an al-Qaeda supporter, was killed by a U.S. drone in Yemen in September 2011, and so was his son a few weeks later. Our guest Mark Bowden's cover story in the September edition of The Atlantic is about the evolution of the U.S. drone program, as well as some of the heated debates in the Obama administration about targeted strikes. His story is titled The Killing Machines, How to Think About Drones. Mark Bowden is national correspondent for The Atlantic, now writer in residence at the University of Delaware, joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and nice to have you back once again on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Your story begins with David and Goliath, I guess, to tell us that warfare has changed over the centuries.
Well, it struck me as the archetypal story of technology and the use of technology on the battlefield because, you know, the story is obviously of this little stripling shepherd lad who slays the giant with a slingshot. And, you know, as I point out in the story, the slingshot is a way for David to sort of ignore the rules of the game. I mean, you're supposed to be a big, bad soldier who can fight with a mace and a sword and a spear, and here he manages to fell the giant with a little device that enables him to propel a missile from a distance and make a lethal strike.
Are you telling us that we are now in a sort of drone-driven war?
Yes, I think that this has become and will increasingly become the way that we fight this effort against Islamic, violent Islamists.
Because what, the U.S. doesn't want to send in ground troops? I mean, the public, I think, is so weary of war and so weary of the casualties of war.
Right. I mean, it's an enormously costly enterprise to project soldiers on the ground to distant places around the world. It places both the soldiers and the surrounding civilians at tremendous risk. This provides a relatively low-cost option, low-cost both in terms of what it actually costs, but also in cost in terms of human life. You don't risk any American soldiers, and you theoretically, and I think in real terms, have the opportunity to very strictly limit the number of civilians who are endangered.
You write about some of the evolution of the drone program, and interestingly, it came from telecommunications. This goes back a couple of decades now.
Yeah.
But that's where drones got their start.
Sure. I mean, I think that it's a really broad misconception about drones, and that is that the cool thing is the little remote-controlled airplane. There's really nothing special about them. What's amazing about the drone is the data link, is the ability to link and vacuum up vast amounts of data with this little toy airplane and feed it via satellite to supercomputers, analysts, to, you know, the enormous infrastructure that now exists to find, track, target enemies or, you know, violent extremists.
So when did the Pentagon see, or when did our Defense Department see that drones were a possibility for warfare?
Well, drones have been around in one form or another for a long time. The Israelis used them in the Six-Day War, I believe. They weren't armed. They were used as in the same way that hot air balloons were used in the Civil War. They provide a method of getting up high and surveilling a battlefield. The ability to link the drone via satellite is what really made these remote-controlled vehicles useful. And it was in the 1990s when the United States was tracking war criminals in Bosnia and Eastern Europe that they began using drones linked in this way as very effective tools for finding and tracking targets. After 9/11, you know, they began weaponizing the drones. And that was just because the delay between fixing on a target and then commissioning or ordering a fire mission from a missile on a ship or on a bomb on an F-16, there was an inherent delay there, and sometimes you would lose the target. And so the idea was, why don't we, put a missile on the drone itself? We can strike while we have the target in our sights. And that began with that strike, the first one we know of in 2002. And since then has become, you know, a huge sort of a mini industry inside the Air Force.
I remember some of those chilling and just amazing videos from the first Gulf War, where a, you know, you could see a bomb or some missile going through somebody's window or through someone's front door.
Right.
Is that part of what we're talking about here?
It is. I mean, once the missile is released, it depends on what kind of missile it is. Some fly to a predetermined coordinate. Most are capable of being controlled by the controller, who can adjust them, steer them off course if say, for instance, a civilian walks into the picture. Some of them are laser guided, which is probably what you're talking about.
Yep.
From Persian Gulf War, where you have infantry or a forward operator, someone hiding nearby who is able to literally paint the target with a laser, and the missile will follow where that laser points. So you can literally thread, you know, missiles in windows and things.
I mean, it's so uncomfortable in a certain way to talk in such antiseptic terms about targeted strikes and killing people. But at the same time, I'm thinking about the carpet bombing of previous wars.
Yeah.
Of you and I grew up during the Cold War when we were worried about annihilation by the USSR.
Yeah, I find it, you know, actually a little ironic, Marty, that, you know, in my childhood, our childhood, the you know, we had thermonuclear arsenals pointed at one another. Mm-hmm. We had weapons that were capable of killing millions of people at a time. Now we find ourselves sort of tied in knots over a weapons system that literally chooses one target and can, in many instances, hit that person alone. And so it doesn't seem to have diminished our horror, nor should it, I think, of warfare and of killing people. I mean, it's a terrible thing to do. But if you have, as a nation, as we have, made a decision that we're going to war, when you're at war, that's what it's about.
But better to use drones than to use airplanes and bombers?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, far more precise. I mean, if you've made already the horrible decision that you're going to drop a bomb on a village, you're going to kill, you know, just about everybody in the village. If you can instead selectively target the exact person that you're trying to kill, that, to me, is an advance in humanitarian warfare.
Which is an uncomfortable two words that you just put together there.
Sure. But, you know, war is a fact. You know, international agencies, countries have been struggling with rules of war, how to engage in warfare humanely. And there are many, many rules, you know, banning the use of chemical weapons, for instance, the treatment of prisoners, that govern the actions of armies at war. And I think all of them are designed to eliminate unnecessary killing. The three principles of lawful warfare are necessity, and the other is proportionality, and the other is discrimination. And, you know, drones are a huge advance in the categories of proportionality and discrimination.
You interviewed a pilot. I'm using the quotations here because he was thousands of miles away from his target. But you interviewed him after he fired a Hellfire missile and killed some people. He had been tracking them, and then it was his job to use a drone and kill his target, so to speak. He was extremely upset about what he had done. And I think for many people who think of this as just a great big video game, myself included, that was a surprising response.
Yeah, it was. I mean, but the part of it that was surprising to me, because I've talked to lots of soldiers who had to fire and kill people in combat, mm-hmm. it's always or usually disturbing to kill someone. And there's a fairly strong human reaction there of revulsion, of having crossed a boundary, and to having done something terrible, albeit in some cases for very justifiable reasons. In this case, his response, this kid's response, went further. He had that reaction of, I feel bad because I've just killed four people. But on the other hand, he feels bad because he himself was at no risk.
Right.
He was in a perfectly safe place. The Marines he was protecting on the ground, the Taliban fighters he killed, were in a field of combat risking their lives. And here he's able, with the push of a button, to intervene decisively and yet, you know, kick a coffee break an hour later. To him, he felt that it was unfair. and that he was unworthy of playing that role.
I mean, the kind of Band of Brothers thing? I mean, unfair because his fellow Marines were there at risk and he wasn't?
Exactly. And I think also, you know, if you're a soldier on the ground and your life is at risk and the lives of your buddies are all being at risk and you shoot back under those circumstances, even though you might feel revulsion at having killed someone, you have the knowledge that you yourself were at risk and your friends were all at risk and you did what you had to do. When you remove the person who fires the kill shot from that emotional context, he's reporting for a normal shift in his booth in an air-conditioned office building, you know, a continent's away, and he pushes a button and kills four people. It just feels you don't have all of that emotional justification for having done something so final and terrible.
You go home and have dinner with your family, right?
Right. You know, and this was a case, this was a fairly conventional drone shot, you know, fired over Afghanistan, protecting a patrol of Marines. It's far more disturbing when you're dealing with CIA operatives who will sometimes watch a target with his family, with his friends, going about his daily activities for weeks and months at a time with very high definition close-up video. So that you begin to feel like you are in, you know, perched on this person's shoulder, and then to fire a missile and see the horror of the person's death and dismemberment, to witness the reaction of family members and friends, to, you know, it's very gripping and disturbing emotionally.
I mean, to be so close and yet so far, so close that you can see what they look like, so close because you have watched from afar, you've watched people live their lives.
Right.
And then push the button.
Sure. I mean, it's not entirely new. I mean, it's the difference between, and this goes back to like the Civil War, snipers who would, you know, hide somewhere and watch a target with binocular lenses for a long time and would see, you know, as opposed to someone who fires an artillery shell and someone reports to them later, well, you know, you took out a convoy of vehicles. This, you know, the sniper, the drone pilot, they see the damage that they do.
We're almost having a break here, but would it be fair to say that they know these people or they sort of know of these people?
By definition. I mean, that's one of the big reasons that drones are used, because if you're, you know, going back to that principle of discrimination, you have to make sure that you're targeting the right person, and great efforts are made in observing the activities of someone to determine, you know, is this person involved in the activities we think they are? Is he the right person? Is this exactly the person we're looking for? So, yeah, you quite literally get to know this target. And the other thing about it, Marty, is that even if you're a sniper, you know, you take a shot and generally you move. Drone pilots have to stick around and watch.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. We're talking about drones and drone pilots. Mark Bowden, our guest today on Radio Times. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic, and his cover story in the September edition of The Atlantic is about drones and how to think about drones. Give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. How do you think about drones? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
The Morris Arboretum supports WHYY and invites visitors to see David Rogers' big bugs before they scurry off. These friendly, larger-than-life critters are on display throughout the garden until August 31st. A 600-pound praying mantis, a 17-foot-tall daddy longlegs, and 10 other beastly creatures on exhibit at Morris Arboretum's 92-acre garden in Chestnut Hill. Big bugs now through August 31st. Details at morrisarboretum.org.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back with a day of free live music featuring They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. The WHYY Connections Festival is free for everyone, and WHYY members and sustainers get exclusive access to the Member Oasis tent all day long. They Might Be Giants and more Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza. For a full lineup and to register, visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a look at Egypt with New York Times reporter David Kirkpatrick and treehouses for adults. There is satellite TV, AC, a full kitchen, and 300 square feet of living space 30 feet above the ground.
It's got the comforts of home. It is so cozy. It smells good. It's like we're just here to find peace.
That is next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Mark Bowden, national correspondent for The Atlantic. We're talking about his September edition cover story about the use of drones, the U.S. use of drones. Of course, drones have become the subject or are the subject of much legal and ethical debate. And the article is titled The Killing Machines, How to Think About Drones. And Mark Bowden is a writer in residence at the University of Delaware, obviously joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. And again, that phone number, we want to know how you think about drones. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You were saying right before the break, Mark, that these drone pilots, after these strikes or these kill shots, have to hang around and kind of see what they have done. And that's also perhaps a different part of this kind of warfare?
It is. It's much more intimate. And, you know, I think it's also odd, you know, that people tend to criticize the drone program as reducing war to video games. And in fact, you know, drone pilots, the ones in particularly the ones taking these shots for the CIA or defense intelligence agencies are far more intimately involved with the violence that they inflict, mm-hmm. and with the targets who are the victims of that violence. So in that sense, it's a much more human and disturbing way of waging mm-hmm. war.
Well, civilians are killed by drones. They may not be targeted, but they are killed sometimes by mistake, sometimes because they happen to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right. And, you know, I do believe that, you know, great efforts are made to avoid it. And, in fact, the statistics show, even by those who are critical of the drone program, that they're getting better and better at avoiding civilian casualties. To a certain extent, it's inevitable. You can have a perfect machine that always hits the target that you aim at, which is these aren't that, but they're pretty good. But even that has to be steered by intelligence. And if you target the wrong person, you've just killed an innocent man.
We had Gregory Johnson on the show. You quote him in your piece as well, and he's an expert on Yemen. His belief being that drones don't work well in Yemen because of the kind of kinships and tribalism or tribal connections in that country, that if you kill a stranger, somehow, you know, I have to avenge that killing.
Right. And I think Gregory makes a very strong argument, convincing argument, that the drone strikes over Yemen have actually multiplied opposition to the United States and beefed up the ranks of al-Qaeda in that country. So, I mean, clearly, when you are employing a tactic in a war and the tactic is making things worse, you ought to reconsider what you're doing.
Let me get, it looks like Bill from Chestnut Hill to join our conversation. And Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just curious if the person who's the target has any idea that this thing is coming. Are you just, you got up in the morning and brush your teeth and bang, you're dead? Or, you know, you see other people around you being targeted? I'm just curious about that.
That's a good question.
The target's perspective, what's going on?
Sure, it's a good question. Go ahead.
Sure. Most of these folks, high-level al-Qaeda figures, are aware that they're likely targets. And it's one of the reasons why they're moving to the most, you know, distant, obscure places in the world in hopes that they can avoid being hit. They're not necessarily aware shortly before they're struck, because you can't really see a drone. They fly high enough and silently enough and slow enough that you wouldn't necessarily be aware that one was watching you. But in general, I mean, someone like Ayman al-Awlaki, the American citizen, the Yemeni preacher who was killed by a drone, he was certainly aware that he was a high-value target and probably tried to live his life in a way that would make him, you know, a hard target.
Mm. I remember interviewing reporters who have covered parts of Afghanistan and Pakistan, talking to civilians there, saying that they could hear. I mean, there were parts of those countries where they could, every day, they knew there were drones flying over their heads.
Maybe. With some, I'm sure that the Pakistanis are also flying drones. The drones that are being used by the Air Force and the CIA, I think it's doubtful.
Really?
Because they're very small. They fly very high. They fly very quietly. it's unlikely that you're hearing and seeing them.
You describe, I guess, a kind of a NASA-like central headquarters in many ways in Dubai.
Right.
What does that look like?
Well, I've not been there, but I'm told it looks a lot like, you know, the control centers of NASA during, like, a major space mission. You have a IMAX-sized screen that can put up feed from as many as 60 different drones. You have arrays of tables and with monitors and control sticks manned by pilots, by analysts, by officers who are making decisions, by UN oversight people, hundreds of people in the room. It's a major, big operation, and that's not the only such control center.
But that's and they are looking at gigantic screens of surveillance happening, what, all over the world or certain hot spots in the world?
Well, in recent years, primarily, it's been in Afghanistan. Prior to that, it was Afghanistan and Iraq. And as the United States withdraws from Afghanistan next year, the volume of drone activity will decline greatly. Most drone strikes have been force protection strikes, trying to protect the hundreds of thousands of American soldiers and Marines who are set in, you know, in Afghanistan in hostile ground. When it is reduced only to CIA and intelligence operations, I think we're talking about, you know, a much smaller scale.
Mm. We talked about Yemen and some question about how effective drone strikes have been there in terms of reducing the ranks of al-Qaeda. How about for Pakistan, which has been, and I guess until recently, really a site for a lot of drones?
Well, and I do know that the drone strikes over Pakistan have just decimated core al-Qaeda, by which I mean the organization that Osama bin Laden created that carried off the attacks on 9/11. And I do believe that there is a significant difference between that group, that core al-Qaeda group, and the various sort of franchise operations that have developed around the world that fly the al-Qaeda flag, in that core al-Qaeda was capable of raising money, recruiting people, sending them to the United States for months, pilot training, coordinating really large-scale terrible attacks within the United States and places around Europe. I think these small al-Qaeda franchises are very violent and dangerous in their own neighborhoods for the most part, but they don't quite rise to the level of core al-Qaeda. So those attacks in Pakistan, I know from reading bin Laden's correspondence in the months before he was killed, had devastated his organization and had made them virtually, you know, incapable of operating.
You wrote a book called The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. What role did drones play in that?
Well, they were involved in watching bin Laden's compound from a distance after he had been located. And in a larger sense, they had, as I said, made his organization ineffective, had narrowed and narrowed and narrowed his ability to affect anything. And then, of course, in the final decision-making process to target bin Laden, one of the final options was to deliver a very small missile from a drone.
Let me get that. Looks like Lee to join our conversation. And Lee, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for taking my
call.
I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I have a very grave concern listening to your discussion, and that is that your speaker and also you, Marty, keep mentioning we're at war, but where these drones are being used in Yemen and also in Pakistan, we are not legally, officially at war with those countries. So I'd like very much to have that concern addressed, if that's possible.
Oh, absolutely, Lee. Thanks for the call. Now go ahead, Mark.
There are a number of people who have that opinion, and, you know, it's been raised by opponents of the use of the drone in the various parts of the world outside of the conventional battlefields. I do think it's a minority opinion. The Obama administration, the Bush administration have both operated under the authorization for the use of military force, which specifically authorized lethal action against al-Qaeda and its leaders. The fact that they have scattered to various places around the world, to some people, removes them from the legitimate battlefield. But I think that most people, including someone like Harold Koh, who was legal counsel for the State Department, who was probably, you know, more than anyone in the Obama administration concerned about adhering to international standards would concur that it is legitimate and we are legitimately at war under American law against al-Qaeda's leadership, and that these targets are legit.
It does raise questions, though, about what then becomes a combat zone, whether the world becomes a combat zone if the United States is tracking al-Qaeda wherever they they end up.
And it will become more of a concern as we withdraw from Afghanistan, because we've been operating under the authorization for the use of military force, which Congress passed. Once the formal war zone shuts up, you know, in Afghanistan, then one of the things I know that the Obama administration wants to do is shift the entire framework for using drone strikes from war footing to law enforcement footing. And I do think, and one of the things I point out in my essay is that as we make that transition away from war, the use of drones becomes far more problematic under international law. I don't think I do think drone strikes will continue, and I do think it is possible to obtain necessary authorization if the country feels it's necessary, but it's more problematic.
And that's Mark Bowden, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has a cover story in the September edition of The Atlantic called The Killing Machines, How to Think About Drones. And he is writer in residence at the University of Delaware. He has written a number of books, including Black Hawk Down, most recently The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. There were some stories, even a couple of books, about President Obama essentially picking targets for some of these drone strikes, sometimes pulled out of meetings, sometimes pulled out of dinner with his family or even parties to sign off on these drone strikes. And you write about some of the real arguments within the Obama administration about the use of drones.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the president, who I had a chance to talk to about this, never anticipated that he would be playing this role. But he's very concerned about the tool that drones provide the country, realizes, I think, the potential for abuse and mistakes, and so has kept a very tight hold on it himself. Signs off, either he or at one point it was the director of the CIA, were authorized to give the order to take a shot. So it does at least keep the decision chain very tightly held.
But you write about a former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, a man named Cameron Munter, and there was a real disagreement about, you know, whether he would sign off on this or what his responsibility was in this chain of command.
Right. I mean, he would participate in these decision meetings. These are the meetings where they drop the final list of targets to present to the president. And as the ambassador to Pakistan, he was wrestling with the crisis that these drone strikes were creating in U.S. relationships with many factions in Pakistan, and also with, you know, a popular opposition in Pakistan. So what he tried to utilize his authority as ambassador to that country to veto a suggested target for a drone strike, and found himself in the middle of a tug of war between the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and Leon Panetta, who was then the director of the CIA, at which point the decision had to be kicked upstairs, and basically the CIA won that argument.
Wow. And you even describe Petraeus going to Pakistan and sort of sounds like sort of mollifying things with Ambassador Munter.
Well, under the codes governing, you know, the use of force by the United States around the world, technically the ambassador to a country has the final authority over the use of force, and Munter had tried to exercise it without success. And I think Petraeus's point was, well, you know, we would rather not have to deal with, you know, we don't want to be butting heads with you in Pakistan, so what you need to do is let me know earlier on in the process if you have a problem, and we will deal with that problem ourselves before it rises to the level of a Secretary of State and Director of the CIA. And he kept his word. He managed to avoid that becoming a problem.
But since this has been, I guess until recently, under the responsibility of the CIA, that means that the public doesn't have access to a lot of this information. I mean, it's been allowed to operate in the shadows.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, when we're operating on war footing, that gives a a great deal of legitimacy to the argument for secrecy. I think and hope that as we move to a law enforcement model, that it will force a higher level of transparency, mm-hmm. both in the procedure by which we make a decision to strike someone, but then also the evidence for justification for the use of the drone and the use of that strike. I think the more transparent it becomes, the more we as American citizens can intelligently decide whether this decision was a good decision or a bad decision, whether we agree with it or not. I'm one who I'm not opposed on principle to ever, making a strike from a drone, but I would be, would want to know, that power was being exercised with a great deal of care, and that the concerns that I would have as a human being were being adequately addressed. And we won't know that until this becomes more transparent.
One thing you write is, for one thing, our military and intelligence agencies generously define combatant to include any military age male in the strike zone. So when we think about casualties and civilian casualties and who's a combatant, I think that that definition is probably a lot different from those people on the ground and even maybe the way the public feels.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think that there is a natural tendency of the military in war to continue to sort of push out on the definition to broaden the number of potential targets. I mean, they, welcome the opportunity to strike at the enemy. And so they are much more inclined to more broadly define who is a legitimate target, who is the enemy. I think that that needs to be pushed back against. Mm-hmm. And I think the Obama administration has done that, but all within secrecy, all mm-hmm. within the confines of their secret meetings. And I just think in order for this program to rise above the current clouds of suspicion and condemnation, we need to know more about how they make these decisions and why.
Well, again, we're almost up on a break here, but I wonder whether some of the criticisms of the drone program are also the same criticisms of the NSA. I mean, that there are these government agencies who are doing things in our name, and we don't necessarily know what they're doing.
Yeah, I just see it, Marty, as a pendulum swinging back in the other direction. I mean, after 9/11, we were all wanting to know, why didn't we know about this? Why aren't we doing more to target these al-Qaeda figures? And so, authorizations for all of these programs were put in place. Now, 10 years later, we feel safer. Al-Qaeda is no longer conceived by most people as the threat that it was. So now we're reevaluating, whether we want this degree of intrusion in our, private lives, in the uses of cell phones and computers, whether we like the idea of drone program that has, flying caps all over the world and targeting people. So it's a very healthy and natural drawing back from those war powers.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Mark Bowden is our guest, national correspondent for The Atlantic, and he is the author of the September cover story of The Atlantic about drones. He's also a writer in residence at the University of Delaware, and we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think about drones? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
This week in This American Life, a sheriff in California has a problem. His deputies spend too much time busting small-scale pot farmers. So he devises a plan. He'll let the farmers grow their pot as long as they register with the sheriff. Pretty good, right? Bust the big guys instead. So what did his deputies think?
The sheriff is off his rocker.
Stories of people who are just trying to help this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
They say you're all corrupt. Mexican police, you all take bribes?
Not all of us.
In the new FX series, The Bridge, Damian Bachir plays a Mexican detective working a homicide case with El Paso cops on the Texas-Mexican border. On the next Fresh Air, he'll talk about that role and playing a drug lord on the Showtime series Weeds and Fidel Castro in the film Che. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Three bullets that nearly took a life but did not change a mind.
The kids who approached us were doing exactly what my friend and I were doing. I don't think the fact that they were black and wearing hoodies would have been appropriate grounds for a police officer to stop them and frisk them.
A shooting victim who says that indiscriminate stop and frisk programs make society less safe. Next time on The Takeaway from Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. And if you're just joining us, Mark Bowden is our guest today on the show. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic, and his cover story, the September edition of The Atlantic, it has to do with the evolution of the U.S. drone program and some of the contradictions in that drone program as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Rich. From Upper Moreland to join us. Rich, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Mark, I'm a former Navy pilot. One of my questions would be, where do we stand in anti-drone development? Let's face it, we're not going to be able to keep this proprietary drone business going forever.
The idea is what if drones are flying over this country, is that what you mean, Rich?
Sure. I mean, let's face it, you know, we're going to probably see other countries develop, not necessarily the Yemenis or the Al-Qaeda, but they can source these products through other countries who have the technology and the wherewithal to do this.
What do you think, Mark?
Well,
Thanks, Rich.
I think, you know, Rich probably would understand this as well as better than I do. You know, drones are first and foremost observation vehicles. They're for surveillance, and they're better at it than anything we've ever been able to put up in the air. But they're a very noisy target in the sky. They have, you know, this enormous data link with a satellite and back to their, you know, analysts in Washington. So it's like they're they have big neon digital lights flashing. Here I am, you know, I'm right up here in the sky. They fly very slow. Some of them are actually propeller driven, many of them. They're easy targets. So the idea of other countries, you know, mounting a drone program and trying to fly them over the United States is not likely to happen. You need to be able to fly a drone in controlled airspace. One of the remarkable things about the American military is our ability to completely own the sky over whatever battlefield that we're engaged in. So that's what enables us to fly fleets of drones that are rarely targeted, you know, successfully. But if somebody tried to fly one over Cleveland and the United States, I mean, we would know it was there. We could probably hijack it by intercepting its digital links. We could easily shoot it down. They're about as hard to shoot down as a hot air balloon. So I think, you know, if you want to bomb an American city, you probably do better putting it in a backpack and walking out to Main Street in the Boston Marathon than trying to do it with a drone.
But can we expect American drones to be shot down because they are such easy targets? I mean, that's got to be in the future.
We can if we're foolish enough to fly them over countries that have sophisticated, you know, ground-to-air attack capabilities or where we don't completely own the sky. I know, for instance, when we were observing bin Laden, we had to use drones that would fly in Afghan airspace because Pakistan has an air force and a sophisticated ground-to-air system. If they had an intruder, they would know about it soon enough. This was this would be a loud, noisy intruder. So I just don't think it's... other countries are developing them, have them, but it's not a technology that will really threaten the United States.
Didn't a drone crash in Iran?
Yeah, apparently. Either that or they shot it down or hijacked it. It probably crashed. You know, one of the amusing things is that they put it on national TV and it's a big, you know, supposedly a big intelligence coup. And what they've got is essentially a model airplane with a technology that you can buy at Radio Shack. It illustrates that the sophistication of drones is not the aircraft, it's the data link.
And you say in this piece, think about drones as just airplanes. I mean, we shouldn't think of them as anything more than that.
Exactly. They are basically data vacuum cleaners. I mean, they just suck up data. And what's important about them is that we are able to collect that data via satellite, plug it into supercomputers, and just do incredible things with it. That's what this technology is really all about.
Let me see what Rocco from Delaware County has to say. Rocco, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. My question and comment was somebody earlier called about them targeting in countries where we don't have a declared war.
Right.
My question would be, what's to stop them from targeting someone in this country, especially with the new laws that Obama signed in place with drones flying in our airspace?
Thanks for the call, Rocco. You want to take that, Mark?
Well, there are a whole host of constitutional protections that basically you would have to have our legal system collapse totally before the United States would be legally authorized to target an individual within the United States. There are laws keeping military operations separate from law enforcement operations. I think I have a certain amount of faith in our legal system and in our constitutional structure that while it's capable, I mean, we're certainly capable of targeting people in the United States, just as we're capable of shooting someone with a sniper rifle who's a suspect in a murder case. These things don't happen because there are penalties and laws that stop them from happening.
Thanks for the call. Let me see what Vince from Northern Liberties has to say. Vince, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just had a quick question for you guys.
Sure.
About the use of these drones. We're talking a lot about them being used for kind of military purposes and in wartime. I'm wondering if these drones have any purposes or uses outside of that, like humanitarian or environmental purpose uses.
Well, indeed. Yeah,
yes,
go ahead, yeah.
They're tremendously valuable for a whole host of reasons. And again, it's because of the ability to vacuum up vast amounts of data. So, for instance, environmental surveys, crop surveys, archaeological studies, transportation, facilitating transportation flows. You know, in the past, if you wanted persistent aerial surveillance, you either had to keep a relay of airplanes in the sky or use a satellite, which passes over, you know, once every, 12 or 13 hours over a particular place. What a drone does is enable very low-cost, persistent surveillance, and that has applications in a very wide range of humanitarian, scientific, practical issues, as I said, like traffic management in cities. Law enforcement is one of them, and obviously it has a military application.
Vince, thanks for the call to Radio Time. So we should get used to being surveilled?
Without a doubt. I mean, I think the real question here, Marty, to me is when you step into public space, do you have an expectation that you are in private? My feeling is public space is public space. If you're walking down the sidewalk of a major city, you're in a public area. You are, whether you know it or not, already being surveilled by cameras on buildings and sometimes by helicopters overhead. And remember the slow speed chase of O.J. Simpson? That was aerial surveillance. But it costs a heck of a lot more to keep a helicopter with a pilot up in the air for hours and hours and hours than it does to put up a little toy aircraft mounted with lenses and a data link where you can do this, for 24 hours a day for as long as you want to do it. It's very, very useful. It could be like any other tool abused, but it's, to me, public space is public space.
So GPS, I mean, all the things that we use to navigate the public world, just we have to get used to the fact that there's all this data about us somewhere.
Sure. I mean, it just means that that the information is being collected more efficiently. I have every expectation when I'm in public, someone is watching me or someone can come back and watch me. If I open fire, there's going to be a video record of me doing so somewhere. Drones make that far more likely, but to me it's not a quantitative, it's quantitative, it's not a qualitative shift in the kind of surveillance.
Are you comfortable with the NSA not listening in on your phone calls, but tracking your phone calls or knowing that you called someone in Dubai?
It doesn't bother me at all. I think that my understanding is that they are collecting vast pools of data. No one is actually looking at them because who could? I mean, who would have the time? But what it means is you have a pool of information that you can go fishing in when you do need to find something important. And if you want to go fishing in that pool, you have to go get permission to go do it. To me, that's the way the system ought to work. I think it's a useful tool. I personally don't feel invaded or threatened by it.
But there is all the, I mean, it's interesting to think about all this data that some, not somebody, but I guess some machine is, going through looking for X's and O's and then trying to find meaning out of all that data.
Well, initially all it's doing is collecting it.
Right.
and storing it. There would be no, it would be humanly impossible for anyone to wander in and start looking at all that stuff. In order to make sense of that much data, you need supercomputers to do searches. So yeah, if you get a ping on a phone call in St. Paul, Minnesota, to a known terrorist leader in Somalia, and you want to figure out, okay, who's this guy in Somalia talking to? Who is this person? To me, that's a legitimate national defense interest, and you would then have to go to a court. You'd have to ask permission. You'd have to show justification. Then you maybe go listen. But that, but what the data pool enables you to do is go back and find those things that could be useful, could be important. And if you eliminate the data pool, I mean, you basically eliminate a very useful tool in preventing the kinds of terror attacks that we've seen in the past.
Let me see what Bob from Kutztown has to say. Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Well, the, your guest seems to be talking about drones in terms of very high technology and data links and satellites and so on. But it seems to me that if you're a terrorist group or something, you don't need all those things. It's all you need is a remote-controlled airplane, and there are airplane clubs, flying model airplane clubs all over the country. There's just two clubs within 50 miles of my house. It seems to me that they could get these planes, maybe a bigger model of them, and load them with explosives and do terrible damage, all, you know, in any major city. It doesn't have to be a specific target in a place. And I just saw in the news last week, I think Israel had used a drone in, to attack some Palestinians who were firing rockets. Is anybody thinking about the defense about against these kinds of things?
Bob, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, Bob's right. I mean, but that's been true for the last 100 years. I mean, you could mount a bomb on a aircraft and or a model airplane and fly it into a building or into somebody's house. You know, the truth is that the use of a drone to deliver a strike like that is one of the most inefficient, clumsy ways of doing it. Why not just drive a car into the city like the guy who drove up into Times Square and blow it up there? Why not carry, like the Boston Marathon bombers, the bomb in a backpack? You have far less chance of being observed and stopped. In particular, I mean, as I said, a drone, if you're controlling it remotely, is a very noisy object in the sky. I mean, there's a very loud data link going on. It makes them really easy to find. It makes them really easy to shoot down. It's just a dumb way to go about, you know, delivering a target. Unless you can do it in totally controlled airspace, which is what the United States has over Yemen and Afghanistan and Iraq.
Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We did have a caller we couldn't get on wondering about the notion of targeted assassinations. And there was a period in this country's history where we were assassinating leaders of various factions and countries. There's some laws passed to make that illegal. How does this fit into that?
Well, if what we're talking about here is Presidential Order 12333, which is not a law. It's actually a presidential order. And it was drafted to prevent the sort of clumsy efforts that the CIA was making to kill Fidel Castro and other political leaders in countries. So it targets, it prohibits political assassination.
And political being the important word?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the, you know, it's a stretch to say that targeting members of an terrorist organization who are plotting an act of mass murder rises to the same import as a political assassination. So I don't really think it's the same thing. And secondarily, I mean, a presidential order is a presidential order. The next president can issue a new order, which in fact has happened, which can, you know, countermand the original order. In this case, Congress authorized the president to use lethal force against Al-Qaeda. So, you know, there is no sound legal argument on that basis.
You wrote Black Hawk Down, as we know, and that was about the disastrous military effort in Somalia. You also wrote about Osama bin Laden and what happened in Abbottabad. I don't know, about 20 years between those two events.
Yeah.
What I guess, do you take away from those two special operation actions?
One thing I take away is how much better we've gotten at doing them. The raid to Abbottabad was carried out flawlessly. The fact that we were able to insert those troops in Pakistan without alerting any of their defenses was extraordinary. But what both illustrate to me are the enormous risks that you take when you send in ground forces. In the case of Abbottabad, things went well. And yet, anyone who was involved in planning that mission will tell you that the risks were extraordinary. We had aircraft, Air Force jets scrambled to fly in to escort those helicopters out of Pakistan, which would have meant going into combat against Pakistan's Air Force. If a Pakistani army unit had come across those SEALs on the ground, there would have been a big fight. A lot of people would have been killed, including possibly all of those SEALs who went in on that mission. So anytime you undertake a ground operation like that, inserting American forces, the risks of casualties, both to your own people and to civilians, is far, far greater. And the best illustration of that is Black Hawk Down.
Sure. Where,
you know, we sent in a force for a snatch and grab, and what, 500 to 1,000 Somalis ended up dead, and 18 American soldiers. I mean, it's, things go well, it looks like a, you know, a magic solution. If it doesn't go so well, you got heads rolling.
Right. But when we think about the future, perhaps even the future of war, it's special operations and drones?
I think those are the choices. If you are deciding to continue to target these al-Qaeda leaders who are living in obscure places all over the world, the only way to go after them is either on the ground or in the air.
Well, as always, Mark Bowden, you give us a lot to think about. Thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. His cover story in the September edition of The Atlantic titled The Killing Machines, How to Think About Drones, and he is writer in residence at the University of Delaware. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, podcasts, email, the archives. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us. Do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.